All right, again, good evening to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco and California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at thecommonwealthclub.org. I am Mark Fishkin, and I'm the executive director of the California Film Institute and the director and founder of the Mill Valley Film Festival. Tonight, we will be discussing the exciting new film, Olive, the first feature film ever shot on a cell phone, starring two-time Academy Award-nominated actress Jenna Rollins, one of my favorite actresses of all times. The film follows the story of a little girl who transforms the lives of three individuals without speaking a word. Produced independently of any corporate financing, the filmmaker's goal is to have the first independently financed feature on a cell phone to appear on 2,000 screens or more across the United States without the backing of any major studio, a very significant challenge. Now let me introduce tonight's speakers. I'd like to start with my far right, with Chris Kelly, who is the former executive at Facebook and is the executive producer of Olive. Hooman Khalili is a radio personality, a YouTube personality. He is on 97.3 FM on the Sarah and Vinny Morning Show, and it's always fun to have Hooman with us. Pat Gillis is a San Francisco independent filmmaker and the co-director, co-writer, cinematographer, and editor of Olive. That in itself is amazing. Please welcome all of our panelists. I want to remind everybody you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And again, our guests are Hooman Khalili, Pat Gillis, and Chris Kelly. I am Mark Fishkin. I'd like to just ask you a question. And I know this film is involved with some unique technology. But when it comes down to it, it's all about the story. And this is a very interesting story that really tugs at your heart, which I'm particularly surprised that Hooman is involved in. But regardless of that, I want to ask you all, you know, particularly Hooman and Pat initially, you know, what inspired you to tell this story? And then tell us a little bit about the development of the screenplay.
So the idea of the story came from a couple sources. In 2003, there was an animated film that came out called The Triplets of Belleville. And in my mind, that's the most important animated film ever made. I know that's a lofty statement, but in that movie, for 2 hours, you've got a bunch of characters who don't speak one word, and yet everything is conveyed perfectly. I saw that movie 45 times, and by the 45th time I saw it, an idea started to come to some kind of weird form in my mind. At the exact same time, I started looking on the internet to see if there had been a full-length feature film shot entirely on a cell phone. There was no cell phone film, really, to date at that point, and this idea wouldn't leave my mind. And so I immediately got together with Pat in February of 2010, and I said, listen, I have an idea for a film. And it was together between the two of us that we were able to flush out what you saw on the big screen this evening. You know, so often in life, every single one of us is down in the dumps. We're in a ditch. We're depressed. We're alone. And the way human beings work, and the way we work through these problems isn't by having somebody browbeat us to death, but it's by having somebody sit right across from you and listen to you, and you hear yourself talk, and you hear yourself work through those problems. That's how human beings work. And so in this film, you saw a little girl who didn't speak one word sitting across from three individuals. And the whole point of her being there was just to listen. Every single one of us has had that friend that sat across from us and has touted a ton of advice. The worst friend ever. When all you need is somebody sitting across from you and listening. And that really is at the heart of this film. Because if you have somebody sitting across from you listening to you and you hearing yourself talk, you can work through your issues. And it's a massively transformative thing, but it's a very real thing. And that pretty much is at the heart of the film.
Well, Pat, you both wrote this together. So did you come sit down and decide that this was a theme that was interesting to you, or did the characters pop out at you first?
For me, it was the other greatest animated film of all time, Popeye. So I... No, I'm kidding. No, Hooman came to me with the idea and said, you know, we hadn't really talked much about the story. He said, I have seen some of your stuff. You've talked about, you know, we were friends through his job at the radio. And he said, I'd like to make a film with a cell phone. And he told me that he wanted to make a feature film with a cell phone. And the first thing out of my mouth was probably the first thing out of everyone else's mouth. I said, why? Let's use a real camera. And he really kind of, you know, Hooman is great at communicating and inspiring people to sort of get in that place, to put you in a challenging position. So we got past the cell phone thing, and we talked about the story, and he really brought three central characters with three sort of archetypical problems. There was the one person who was sort of internal with this weight issue and needed motivation. Was lonely. Then this other person who was a bit of, well, you could call it internal, but external, was this heading into dementia and coping with it with someone. And there's some things in the story that talk about her husband went through the same thing. And then the last person was truly external. These, you know, living in America, losing the one person that was your safety blanket, and then trying to maintain that life. So from there, we created this sort of against the typical three-act play of first 20 pages, plot point, page 80, second plot point, close them out with a, you know, explosion.
Sid Field's book.
Right. Yeah. Sid Field's book, right? So we just made three short stories. And interesting enough, it started out with Horace, then Cyrus, and Jenna's role was the last character. And after shooting the film, we had the luxury of just saying, hey, we got three stories. And we'll do this,
flip them around,
and then we'll keep them in the same row. And it turns out, you know, it sort of worked out better that way. You know, you got to put your best foot forward, and that was obviously, you know, Jenna was a powerhouse. She was great.
I think Alejandro Gonzalez and Iñárritu worked the same way with Babel, actually, on Sirius.
You can move stuff around.
Yeah. Now, Chris, you know, this is your third independent feature that you've been involved in. Congratulations on your Dreams of Sushi, which is in theaters as we speak. What was it that resonated with you?
Well, Hooman and I were friends through other means, through a political friend had introduced us. We had hit it off. And he came to me in early 2011 and said, I want to do this movie using a cell phone as the main camera. And I said, well, that's a great gimmick at the end of the day, but if the movie isn't good, It won't be for, you know, people won't pay attention. You will sort of ruin the moment. Mm-hmm. And so I said, send me the script and let's talk about the story and how it fits together. And he described to me the basic elements. I said, that sounds pretty good, but let me see the script. And, you know, Hooman and Pat did a great job of putting it together and making it sort of hang in a way that I could see this, you know, being shot, being put together as a, you know, good full-length feature. This is the first narrative film that I worked on. Mm-hmm. I had done two documentaries before this, and, you know, I'm going to do one or two more narratives. The film has been more of a hobby than anything else for me at this point, but it's been terribly interesting to learn the basics of the industry and putting something together. And this was an area that I thought that you know, I could provide some expertise on the technology front and also in talking to the technology press about this. And so it all came together quite nicely. And once I became a big believer in the story, I was always a big believer in Hooman, and I met Pat through Hooman and was very compelled by the energy that they wanted to bring to it and the story that they wanted to tell. But, you know, I got super excited about the movie, and it turned out to be, I figured that it would be good. I think it's a great movie. I'm super excited about it. And I think that we, you know, have the opportunity to bring this charming, family-friendly movie to the world is something that I'm very proud of.
Great. I want to, of course, we're going to get to the technical aspects, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you a couple of questions about how it was like working with Jenna Rollins. We had the pleasure of in 2004 doing a tribute to her at the Mill Valley Film Festival. But, you know, A Woman Under the Influence, Gloria.
Somebody's a General Owens fan.
It's Bobby out there, isn't it?
That's either a clarinet or a truck.
All right.
Do you want a Jenna Rowland story? Is that what you're asking for?
I think that's a critical part of
this. All right. Well, there's two. I'll start with what it took to get her on board. And then I'd like Pat to tell the story of the last day before we shot. But when there's actually three. Can we do three? Do we have time for three? All right. So the first was we had started shooting the movie before Jenna Rowland came on board. And Jenna Rowlands wasn't our first choice. Betty White was our first choice. Not too many people know that. And Betty White's agent he spent 2.5 hours with us, locked in a room, didn't take any phone calls, didn't let any interruptions happen. I thought for sure we had Betty White. And lo and behold, I feel like we got arguably one of the finest actresses in the history of film, period. My casting director, a woman named Robin Lippin, calls and says, "Jump on a plane right now. Jenna Rowlands wants to meet you." I said, "Oh, my God." It was our first day of rehearsals with John Skurdy. He'd called in sick because he had eaten bad Thai food the night before. So there I am at Southwest at the Oakland airport paying cash for my ticket, and I'm Persian. That's bad.
Hitting up on watch lists everywhere.
Next thing I know...
the next flight?
I know. Took the next flight. Next thing I know, I'm at Jenna Rowland's house. Her husband, Robert Forrest, answers the door. He says, "Hello, Hooman, come on in." He welcomes me to their bar. There's pictures of Jenna and Betty Davis, her Golden Globes, Frank Sinatra. I couldn't focus. I couldn't think. All I kept thinking was, "Oh my God, my BO is just at a whole new level right now." Lo and behold, Jenna walks in. Robert looks at me and he says, "Hooman, what are you drinking?" I said, "I'll have a sparkling water." He says, "I'm going to have rum on the rocks. Jenna's going to have vodka. What are you drinking?" I said, I'll have the rum as well. Needless to say, an hour and a half pass, and I'm sitting there pouring out my heart to Jenna Rowlands. And during the conversation, she says to me, "Hooman, this script is perfect. I love this script. It's beautiful. And this woman, I know this woman. I've been this woman. Mm-hmm. I can play this role." But she says, "You have to convince me. You're new directors. You've never done anything. And we're doing it on a cell phone, for God's sakes." So, hour and a half later, Robert Forrest looks at me and he says, "Hooman, if we decide to come down there, where will we be staying?" I said, "We'll put you in a suite at the Fairmont Hotel." "Ooh, I like the Fairmont Hotel." "Hooman, if we come down, can Jenna have her own makeup and hair person?" I said, "Absolutely, please, no question." And he says, "Hooman, if it was up to me, I'd say yes." I said, "Robert, if it was up to me, I'd say yes as well." And we both look at Jenna, and Jenna says, "Well, it's up to me." And I'm saying yes. Yeah. Right on the spot, right like that. I was like, "Oh, my goodness." One other quick Jenna Rowland story, and then I'll let Pat tell.
I just want to say, don't you love how people in L.A. still think they're coming down to see us?
Yeah.
just something to hang on to for future filmmakers.
Yep.
You're always going up when you go to L.A. All right, so go ahead.
So Pat and I, you know, we're new at this, and the most offensive thing you can do to an actor, believe it or not, is something called a line read. What's a line read? We had no idea when we were shooting the movie either. The line is, "I love you," and you go up to the actor and you said, "You're not saying that right. Don't say I love you. Say I love you." And you tell them how to read the line. That's the worst thing you can do to an actor, period. So during the film, there were at least three moments where Pat, mostly, gave Jenna a line read.
Oh. It's obvious. It's I love you. To me, it's obvious. Okay.
And before we started shooting the film, Jenna said to both Pat and I, "There is to be no yelling on this set. If we hear yelling, we're going to walk. Mm. And we're not going to come back." And that was a perfect moment for Jenna to stop and yell at us and make us feel this small And the three times we did it, she looked at us, she kind of smirked, and she said, that's an interesting way of reading it. And her husband would just nod and be like, oh, my God, you guys have no idea what you're doing. But she didn't break her own rule. She made a rule, and she kept it herself, and she had every opportunity to break it. The reason I tell that story is just to let you know what a class act she is. She is as pristine and elegant, as sophisticated as you would imagine.
And she's great in this film.
Yeah.
Absolutely great.
Tell the other story.
I think we have a couple of questions from the audience, though. Right. Would you maybe let's get a couple in, and then we'll come back to that other one. This is from an audience member. What advantages do you see shooting a film on a cell phone? Did I read that right? Do you think there will be others?
Well, I would start off by saying I would like you to all turn your cell phones on in solidarity. That whole rule, that's out the window after this picture. You know, there's advantages. I mean, you know, when you start to make a film, and anybody starts to make a film, they pick their camera package. We're going to shoot 35mm film. We're going to shoot 16mm film. We're going to shoot digital. We're going to shoot a 3CCD chip. We're going to shoot on the red camera with a large sensor. So advantages for us were more strategic as they were production-wise. We tested the sensor to see if it would hold up to our competition, and we figured our competition was anybody who's making a movie this year, right? That's how you have to approach things, and it held up. So it was more of a challenge. You know, Hooman said, let's do it this way, and let's challenge ourselves. Let's challenge the you know, wordy 50-cent word. Let's challenge the paradigm. Let's compress this down to the kid at home with a phone in his pocket who wants to make a movie someday, a real movie. So no advantages, probably disadvantages. There was no workflow.
But a significant part of the story that comes out of this is what you can make on the cell phones that are in our hands every day now. That power and the democratization of the technology, what it allows you to do, and not just, I mean, people have been imagining it in the news context and just, and you know, keeping track of your kids every day and their development and, you know, shooting around videos to your family. But you can actually tell a story and edit it and put it in a traditional Hollywood or indie context using this device now. And that was a significant part of the story that we wanted to make reality in this case. And I think we succeeded.
That's it, by the way. That's the movie.
You know, I'm awful clumsy, so you shouldn't
watch
be
out. Don't
these.
Break it.
There it is.
There's only one.
But it's really interesting from our perspective as being in the film festivals and getting submissions for theatrical films playing in theaters is that we get many more submissions now with the lower cost. And that's a significant thing, and it really deals with community and what you're seeing going on now with, I don't need to tell you this, with Facebook and how communication is more democratic. Mm-hmm. Do you look at this in a way as being a chance for it to be more democratic?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, this was an extension of the projects that I've been working on for the last 10 years in technology. Social media is transforming the way that people experience produce content as well as user-generated content. And this allows for the blurring of the lines. It allows for users to move into the produce content area. That once you get a high-def camera on a cell phone, you can think about how the way that narrative film has worked and how you can get those stories onto this. I'm going to do one quick digression here to make this point in a different way about social media and the way that produce content has affected it. And it's, interestingly enough, a Jenna Rowland story, too. So I got to tell her when we had a dinner with her and her husband that when we first aggregated on Facebook, when it was just a college social network, everybody's favorite movies, the movie that came out on top was The Notebook, starring Jenna Rowlands. Mm-hmm. That there was this real deep appreciation among college, probably primarily women, and we did do the demographics on this, and it was primarily women. But who recognized this, you know, this great actress, and they did, you know, Jenna Rowlands was listed as one of the favorite actresses too. But The Notebook was the number one most mentioned film among college students on Facebook in 2006.
Amazing. That's great. Are we going to be taking live questions from the audience as well? Is that time for that? Oh, okay. More questions from the audiences, audience members. Why did you call the movie Olive? What are your plans for the future? And what is your next project? This is, we're only allowed one question. I'm sorry, everybody. So firstly, why did you call the movie Olive?
Well,
I'll think of it while you're talking.
It's a ridiculous story. I went on a date with a girl in 2007. It was just one date, and we hadn't seen each other for 2 years or so. And next time I saw her, she was knocked up. And I said, "Wow, look at you, so big." And she says, "I know." And first question out of 99% of people's mouths is, "What's the name?" And 99% of the time, they say, "Oh, we haven't decided." But she immediately said, "Olive. My kid's name is Olive." And for some reason, that stuck with me. And I know it's a small, silly story, but at that moment, I loved that name. And I don't know, it's just such a...
In the first past, it was Hanley or something.
Oh, was
Harley.
It? Oh, was that?
If you're pregnant, he's a name picker. He's got names. It was a different name at the beginning.
So that's where the name originated from. Just a random meeting on the street.
I want to remind everybody you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guests are Hooman Khalili, Pat Gillis, and Chris Kelly from the film Olive. The other part of this question is, what are your plans for the future? Are you working on another project, or is it hard to think about at this moment when you still have another 2,000 screens to...
we have two down.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So my next film is going to be done on a record player. So I'm pretty much... I've got about a four-year plan. No, we're all working on continuing projects. Just recently, I wrote a script for there's another executive producer on the movie, Bill O'Keefe, and he has the film rights to the book America's Still the Place, and it's about a local gentleman here in the 70s who broke some racial barriers, so we just finished a script on that and hopefully get that in production. Chris has all kinds of stuff going on in Hooman.
Yeah, I'm working on it. There's a film that's about to start shooting in New York called Last I Heard with Paul Sorvino. That I've gotten involved in, so I'm going to do a little bit more producing and to continue learning the ropes in the film industry. But I spend most of my time on technology investing still.
This question is a continuation of the technology issue that we've been talking about, is this the beginning of a new genre? And can you see these techniques moving forward? So again, it's about the democratization of filmmaking. But could you kind of expand on this in terms of how you're looking at this maybe for other platforms, not just for theatrical exhibition, which is your goal to be in 2,000 screens to kind of compete with that theatrical model, but in terms of streaming and video demand and other aspects, Netflix, et cetera?
Well, first thing is, to go along with the first part of your question, as soon as we announced this film, it was TechCrunch that originally broke the story, and literally a couple days after the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times, 45 cell phone movies came into production. Right after, literally 48 hours after. One of them even stars Macaulay Culkin. Watch out. One of the things we've played around with is talking with Nokia about having this film on their new cell phones to be one of the things that comes along with the phone. I mean, for goodness sakes, it was shot on their hardware. So that could be a hugely advantageous thing, especially when cell phones are trying to market themselves. You know, if it comes preloaded with a movie or two that was shot with that phone, I think that would be a really attractive thing to the consumer.
Well, one of my technology investments is a company called Fandor, which is an independent film streaming site based just a few blocks from here up on Market Street. And, I do think that there's a radical change in film distribution and in distribution of all produced content. Some of that has to do with social media and the way that people are sharing things, the conversations that people have about film are being reflected in social media all the time, with people updating Facebook statuses and Twitter feeds with what they're watching, what they're doing. You know, I heard about this great film. You know, we have great buzz around Jiro Dreams of Sushi coming, which is in theaters right now, and it's driving great box office. So there is this radical change, and Fandor is attempting to capitalize on that with a subscription model around getting access to a curated collection of thousands of independent films, one of which will, I hope, eventually be Olive. We've got to figure that all out with the distributors and the right timing and all that stuff.
Another question from the audience, specifically, what kind of cell phone is this? What's the lens? How was it attached? What sound equipment did you use? Was the whole film, including the second unit, shot on this and with the same phone? I presume so, if you say there's only one of these phones in existence. But could you give us a little bit more behind-the-scenes information about this? And also, I understand there's an aerial shot in this as well.
There is. And before Pat answers this, I want to say, you know, making this cell phone work like a film camera, a real movie camera, was an incredibly difficult, daunting task. And it took somebody who would think outside of the box, who was a genius in his own right to make this happen. And Pat was 100% behind.
I thought you were talking about Chris.
Oh, no.
Waiting for the punchline.
So, yeah, tell him about that.
It's a Nokia N8, and I don't think it ever actually got to America. But at the time, and Heumann had discovered the phone, it has a 12-megapixel camera and a Carl Zeiss lens. Carl Zeiss is known for cinematic lens. I mean, he does some of the greatest stuff with, you know, Ari and Fujinon. And Heumann got a hold of one off of Amazon, and it came from Finland?
Finland, yeah.
And so we went online and got an English manual and went through it. The problem with filmmaking with something like this, a consumer device, not even prosumer, is that it's all automated. The focus, the iris, the color balance. So to get past that, we had to do it externally. Ironically, shooting this film was probably more like shooting a 16-millimeter film in the 70s than it was some futuristic thing, because the camera was set, and we just flooded lights to trick the camera into thinking it was always daylight. We did secondary sound, and because of Chris's involvement, we treated it like a feature film. We had secondary sound, we had makeup, we had light package, dollies, cameras, jibs. A portion of the film was shot without this adapter when it was just focused to infinity, the helicopter shots and the wide shots, because you didn't need that shallow depth of field, and that's all this does. It's a magnifier onto ground glass, so you could put a prime lens on the front. And that's really all it is. I mean, it's connected with tape.
But every frame of the film was shot on that camera.
And can I give Pat a few more props? He's not going to brag about himself, so I'm going to brag about him. When you have a 35-millimeter lens that's built properly, and not to say we built it improperly, or Pat built it improperly, there's a series of mirrors. And what those series of mirrors do is they take the image that the camera's looking at, and they flip and flop it so that it's right side up and intuitive instead of being upside down and counterintuitive. What Pat did is he bought a 1940s movie camera. And he knew back in the 40s they didn't have a series of mirrors in their 35-millimeter lenses either. And he took apart that film camera. And as he was taking it apart, he's like, how did they get their image to flip and flop? And he finally took apart the eyepiece. And inside the eyepiece was a rectangular prism. And that rectangular prism worked exactly like the series of mirrors. And so what Pat did was he took that eyepiece, he aimed it at the camera, and every time he shot, he had a hood over his head. So he was shooting 1940 style with 2011 technology, so no light would come in. So if you go back to the allofthemovie.com website, every shot of Pat with the hood over his head is there so that he could look through that eyepiece. And
it wasn't just an artistic flourish. It was necessary.
Well, that segues right into this next question of why would someone shoot other movie this way? Advantages besides cost is you get to have a hood over your head. Right?
Well, we've actually had meetings with Nokia and other people, and they were so excited after they saw it that you know, hopefully they'll take some of our suggestions and let people modify these and allow some customization inside the phone.
Well, it'd be great if they had a professional model, right. You know, because there aren't many cell phones that have this kind of, this advanced camera, video camera techniques.
That's right. Filmmakers want to turn things off. We're not really excited about automation. That takes all the fun out of it. You know, we want to, you know, so if you just turned everything off, it would have been great.
Great.
Well, one other thing along those lines. When we got the phone, we clearly couldn't read the instructions because they were in Finnish. So when we found the cell phone hacker, he's the guy that went to who knows where, but he got us an English manual. But we had to hire a cell phone hacker to go into the phone and disable a bunch of things. It's a little complicated, but we were able to make it work.
I thought Nokia had an office in Petaluma.
Is that true? There's one in
Palo Alto.
Palo Alto, yeah.
The research lab is in Palo Alto. We went down and presented there the other day.
Yeah.
Here's a different question, dealing more with the process of after the film is made. Where do you stand with theatrical distribution? Is there interest in international? And, of course, will you make your money back for the investors?
There's a great deal of interest right now. We're trying to figure out the right distributor for this film. It does have a little bit of a strange demographic niche in that it is a charming, family-friendly movie. And that, you know, is not a something that, you know, nothing blows up. You know, we're not going to get a terribly young audience. This is a movie, you know, for families with children who often don't go to movies these days. We also think that it has a good older demographic appeal, and we think that younger kids can see it. So we're working very hard on finding the right distributor for our type of movie. But think it will actually catch on quite rapidly once we get it in front of some more mass audiences.
We applied to the Cannes Film Festival. We were on the shortlist for the Academy Awards. You know, it's a process. It takes time. And, you know, not to I just kiss Pat's ass, so now it's time for me to kiss Chris's ass and say, you know.
Can you say that?
Can you say that? That's a yes.
Yeah, there we go.
You know, having
a... We don't say that in the film, though, by the way.
Right. Having an investor on board who's patient, reasonable, calm is paramountly important.
And he really wished that's what he had.
This next question, and I think this fits into what you were just saying, Chris, both from a content and also from a technical question. How do you think Olive will impact the youth of America if it goes mainstream?
Well, I mean, we hope that it'll encourage thousands of independent filmmakers who take their cell phones and try to put something together. We think it's more powerful than a, you know, a Super 8. You know, J.J. Abrams made a movie called Super 8 about kids making a monster movie you know, last summer. And I think that we should have literally thousands and tens of thousands of kids making their own movies and you know, getting them off their phones and onto their PCs and Macs, and editing them and putting them together in ways that they want to tell their stories, uploading them to YouTube and to Facebook, and to spreading them, you know, however they want. I think that every kid should have the ability to be a filmmaker and tell the stories visually, and we hope that this will be inspirational for them.
Now, for any of you, this film again is very positive and it has a lot to say, and it's very different from a lot of films that relate to the youth of America. But if you know, you know, of course, though, but what's happening on Facebook and other areas now, they're undercovering terrorists, and there's a whole other side of young people that we're seeing now. Do you think there's a chance in terms of films that have this kind of positive message that could relate to young adults?
I think reaching everyone with the transformational message of this little girl, you know, touching three people's lives, helping them, you know, get out of the dumps, as women put it, is inspiring for everyone. And you know, we hope that both the backstory about the technology and how this was put together, and the story that's told in the movie will be inspirational.
And if I could address the white elephant in the room, you know, if this question hasn't already been written, it's going to come. How do we find the little girl? Who is the little girl?
That was my next question.
Oh, all right. You want to ask him?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, there's more than one great actress in this movie, right. And that is the young girl who plays Olive. And I was going to ask you, where did you find her?
So I cast the entire film. I cast everybody except the motorcycle driver, who was a dear friend of Pat's, and I thought he was great. I love that guy. He was perfect for that role. We had kind of sketched out a visual image, and Pat's like, oh, I know this guy. So he brought that.
Drinks a lot, but he'll be fine.
So we initially did a camera test for Nokia back in January of 2011. And when we did that camera test, we had found this little girl in Marin, and she worked out so well for the camera test. When it came time to cast the actual film, you know, Pat sat me down and he said, listen, this is the girl. You don't need to look any further. He fought for her. He really believed in her. And it's an interesting thing working with a child because it's easy to, even though she's the star of the movie in so many ways, it's easy to forget about her needs. And it wasn't until the first week of shooting was finished that Pat sat me and Frank Simeone down, who's our line producer, and said, listen, the needs of this little girl need to be addressed. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to have her sister on the set with her every day. We're going to have her mom on the set with her every day. We're going to have games for her to play. And the moment we did that, like, she was great the first week, don't get me wrong, but it transformed her. And if any of you are ever going to make a movie or dive into film in any level, and you have a little kid on board, really go out of your way to address them. Get them kids' food. Get their friends on the set with them. Do everything you can. Go out of your way because in so many ways, I mean, look, this might be a little grand, but and I think we're looking at the next Elizabeth Taylor in Ruby Alexander. I think she's that great.
It's glad you didn't make her work too many 16-hour days, though. That was good.
You know, we did have one 16-hour day.
I hope that she stays with the young Elizabeth Taylor and doesn't, you know, sort of end up in the rougher areas later in her career.
Tell them about our 16-hour day.
It was 16 hours. Everyone here has probably done it. It's just, you know.
It was the hardware store scene. Because we had that hardware store for one day on a Sunday when they were closed. And it was long and it was intense, and we had to get everything in on that day. And you know, Pat doesn't want me to tell the story, but
you basically have to. It's like moving out of your apartment into another apartment in one day and throwing a birthday party, surprise party. I mean, it's just like the work never stops. You can't even enjoy the party. It's just, and you know, you've got these things coming. So the actors were phenomenal. Ruby wasn't on that day. It was just all the adults, and that was our fight scene. And the sun was going down. We started shooting handheld because just rigging the camera was going to take too long. Hopefully you didn't notice.
So, Hooman, this was the first film that you directed. I know, Pat, you've directed before. Was this the hardest thing you ever did?
Absolutely, hands down, bar none. I mean, I used to walk onto the set. Everybody on the that we hired for the crew was really seasoned. For example, Frank Simeone, who I mentioned, his first film was Apocalypse Now. So he was, and I used to walk onto the set for the first week or two, and I said, listen up, everyone. Nothing is going to go wrong today. And everyone would just look at me and roll their eyes and go back to their work. On a good day, a minimum of 30 things would go wrong. On a good day. And on a bad day, 80 things would go wrong. And it was, you constantly have to adapt to every situation. Things you never think would happen. I mean, what? They're cutting their lawn across the street and we can't shoot because of the sound? I mean, it was constant, but it takes about a week or two to get used to it, and then you can pretty much adapt to anything. There wasn't a moment we couldn't overcome, ultimately. And in the days we needed the weather to cooperate, it cooperated.
I want to remind everybody, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guests are Chris Kelly, Pat Gillis, and Hooman Khalili of the film Olive. Our next question is, how has being in radio and conducting interviews inspired you to make the listener the main character in this movie?
I'll take this one.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
I think this is directed to Hooman.
Well, let me just first address Sarah and Vinny, because I know they've been incredibly kind and generous. They allowed me to take 5 weeks off of work to be a part of this film, and they have incessantly promoted this movie. And they are the voices in the radio, I'm sure you figured that out, but they're throughout the movie. You know, one thing I learned from Sarah a long time ago is if you allow the people around you to shine, then you yourself will shine. You'll even look better. And so because I see how she manages the morning show and kind of works with us and brings out the best in us, I've kind of modeled myself after that in so many ways. She's incredibly kind and generous to the people on the morning show. People not on the morning show, not so much. But the people on the morning show she loves. And so it was really because of her and the way I've kind of watched her for the past 12 years that I've kind of got an appreciation of how to bring out the best in people.
You know, making a movie, as we just said, is a really difficult thing to do. And I was just wondering, you know, back to the technical sides again, would you do this again this way?
You know, we treated it like a real independent feature film. Mm-hmm. So nothing was different other than the camera package and choice. I think that one of the real big stories that I'm most proud of is that, you know, two guys shot a movie on a small camera and edited it on a laptop and an iMac with a real Hollywood star. Got to meet her and work with her, take advice, have her allow us to tell her things. You know, this was done on consumer, readily available equipment. I mean, you could buy the stuff at a hardware store, you could buy the double stick tape down there and get your cell phone camera and make a movie. You just got to get Jenna's number. From Lumen.
You're going to supply that.
But really, I mean, it is there.
Lumen's the source now.
Chris, you know, Chris has been sort of, you know, pounding this over and over again, is that this really is just not as much about the cell phone. It's just, it is in reach. If you have a story and an idea, there's a camera there. There's one in your pocket. You know, I'm sure some 15-year-old kid out there has a laptop and some editing gear. You can make it. It's really, it's kind of scary. It's a bummer for filmmakers.
Can I add one thing to that? Another Jenna Rollins story. Because, you know, she's such a spectacular person. She's 81. And one thing as a co-director / producer you want to do is you always want to keep the crew happy. It's really a really essential thing to making a good film. And so I used to take people out to dinner, fancy places, Cavallo Point in Sausalito, and we were there one night eating.
You never took me out to Cavallo, boy.
I know. You're next. And the phone rings, 10 p.m., the night before our last day of shooting, and it's Jenna. And she says, "Listen, I'm not happy with these last three pages. Can you come to my hotel room?" So Pat and I drive over 11 p.m., and for the next 2-3 hours, we're sitting there with Jenna Rollins rewriting the film. And I have to say, that was the most special moment in the entire filmmaking process for me. Because there we are, with Hollywood royalty, as she cares so deeply about this character and about this film, that and there she is sharing her wisdom and experience. You see, you know, Jenna started with Bette Davis back in the day, and she has so much to give and teach. And the way she presents it is so warm and welcoming. I remember tapping Pat on his shoulder, and yeah, we were tired, and I said, "How cool is this?" He's like, "This is amazing." And that just kind of goes along the lines of Jenna and the kind of person she is. One other thing for screenwriters, don't be married to your screenplay, because the actors are going to change the words. Every line, they're going to change it. It doesn't matter what you write. They're going to add an or a the or an a or completely fumble it, and you're going to end up keeping that. Write it out and let them work their magic on it. You know, you've hired them. Trust them to do the very best job they can. John Skurdy didn't say one line that we wrote. Not one. The fat guy, not one. He changed everything.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the rest of your cast, too, now that you mentioned it?
Yeah, do you want to tell about Chris?
Chris Maher, he's an experienced film actor. He was great. And so Hooman brings up a good point. Chris was I don't like that term. He was, he would read the script as written, verbatim. And he trusted you, and if he had a problem with it, he would really struggle with it because he was committed to those words. Jenna, I'll skip to John. John's like, hey, listen, man, I got the vibe. I'm in the suit. Let's do this. And it was really fun and different and challenging because as a director, you're hearing words that you know are going to have a call and response, you know, 40 pages later, and you're trusting this guy. I mean, he really knows how to sort of, you know, manage your boss, so to speak. And Jenna was right there in the middle. She knew the words, and she knew the ones to say, and then she knew the ones to sort of craft to make it work for her, whereas you had a different person in there. So we really got a master's class on how to work with actors.
The types of actors.
The two pieces of advice that I got were don't ever give a line read again to another actor. And take some acting classes because they're adversarial and they're your partner. You know, it's this very volatile but loving relationship. You know, you've seen the behind-the-scenes stuff, people yelling. And then you watch the movie and think, gosh, that guy held it together, but he was a total train wreck. You know, but they were all great. They were all going in knowing that we were first-time directors, and they were so kind. And I think that we used that to our benefit. We got away with so much garbage with these people that they would not have put up with.
Yeah.
I really like the guy who played the bank manager.
Me too.
Well, you know, talk about amateur actors stepping into roles. But, you know, it was Heumann was good enough to force me into the opportunity to step up act opposite Jenna Rollins. So.
You all got the irony right. The executive producers were
the bank
manager.
Yeah, it's a common position. It's just not normally filmed.
Another actor of note, the girl in the shoe store, that's Randy Zuckerberg. That's Mark Zuckerberg's sister. So she and Chris are really good friends. She comes from a world of musical theater.
Randy has a long history of acting, and she was the perfect person to put into this role and to also act opposite Jenna.
This is a really interesting question. How did you film the monarch butterfly scene? Have most people in this room seen the film? Good.
Yeah, this is so great.
All right, I'll start it, and then Pat can finish it out. So, you know, we wrote the script, and we didn't limit ourselves or cut anything out. Everything that we wrote, we were dedicated to shooting. And we left that little girl, her role, Olive, to be ambiguous. She a spirit, she an angel, she Mother Nature. We leave that up to the audience to decide. But she definitely does have powers. She does have magic powers. And that butterfly blanket scene, there's a man in Sacramento who's a butterfly farmer. And he raises butterflies for weddings and funerals. And I called him, and I said, listen, we don't have a big budget, but I need 60 butterflies. And he said, okay, I like your voice. I like the message of the film. What I'm going to do is come to my house at 7 a.m. I'm going to give you 60 freshly hatched butterflies that were born that morning. Went to his house, and the butterflies come individually in a box. And they're on ice. And one of the reasons they were able to stay on Ruby's finger is because they need to warm up. And they slowly but surely start opening and closing their wings. And no butterflies were harmed, I promise. We let them all go at the end of the day. But there was a trick and there was an art to it. And that opening scene where the butterfly flies right into the camera, how did that happen?
So we shot the film out of sequence. We shot the very first scene of the film we shot last at a woman's home in Nevada who we found on Facebook. And
it's a multi-purpose site.
So here's an example. So that's how the film was shot upside down. So you can see how that would have been sort of a train wreck to follow. It's counterintuitive. But the last scene, the first scenes of the film are still in the camera. I didn't erase the little, you know, micro SD card. So we just put the butterflies in her hand, and we had a couple of dozen of them, and we just, you know, it's like any other, it's like working with dogs and children. You sort of just let them do their thing, 20 times each and then take the best take. And Ruby was really, she's a wrangler.
She is.
We had a real chrysalis.
Real caterpillar.
Real caterpillar.
And that butterfly just, well, so that opening butterfly just flew into the camera. So that was a little bit of special effects. I mean, look, you couldn't train the butterflies to land on her.
There were two.
You
know,
come on.
So there were, it only goes so far.
There were two
butterfly wrangling.
There were two live butterflies on her, practical effects. But that's a good point. That's a good question. There was two butterflies on her as practical effects, and then in the same space at the same outdoor light, we had a green card 4x4, and we just let butterflies go as we held the camera on them, and they used those to track, and then they had other butterflies. But 70% of all the special effects in the film were done in camera, the practical effects. So all those fast ramping things were done in camera. And that's, again, it was more like a 1970s film than a 2012.
Yeah, so every single one of those butterflies is real. Like, we didn't create any of them on a computer. They were butterflies we filmed, and then we changed the way their wings worked, and so that you had a butterfly blanket at that moment.
I think it's time to open up some questions from the audience, if anyone would like the opportunity to...
Don't be shy.
...stand up at the mic and ask any questions.
Yes.
Come on over to the mic so that we can get you on the radio.
Lovely.
Thank you. This is a technical question. Did you say the camera was a 12.5 pixel that you used?
Yeah, this particular... N8 was, I think, 12.1 megapixel camera.
And that was enough pixels to be able to expand that to a movie screen.
Yeah, so the aspect ratio, it was HD. It was 1280 lines by 720 lines. And so before we did any color correcting or anything like that, we actually were able to show it on a large 40-foot screen without any treatment, and it was stunning. It was phenomenal.
Yeah. And the resolution was...
It was, yeah, you know, and it, like any other thing, your blacks would fall apart a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that, the film is very bright. We shot a lot of it outside because it responded best to outdoor light. So we just sort of moved a lot of scenes outside. Mm-hmm. And the interiors were really, really bright. So to trick the camera to always think that it was, you know, outside 6,200 Kelvin.
Thank you.
Let me add one thing to that. So the very first time we screened the film was at Skywalker Ranch in Nicasio. And, you know, Skywalker, George Lucas, and the people that were behind the Skywalker sound, Dennis Leonard and a woman named Sarita Patel, they wanted to help us, but they wanted to make sure the film held up. And we knew that if it held up at that movie theater, it would hold up in any movie theater in the world. So Skywalker Sound did all the sound design for this movie. It was mixed for 5.1 surround sound. We did have a 30-piece orchestra for the film. That is a completely original score done by a guy named Jacob Yaffe. And so we, like I said, we went out of our way to get the very best people on board. And, you know, thank you to the people at Skywalker for the reduced price.
Yeah.
Thank you for that amazing...
Absolutely. Well, and Ben Lear's and Ben Lear's beautiful.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about
too.
There's some wonderful songs in this. Could you?
Yeah, we had an amazing music director. Her name is Brooke Wentz. And so, what I did was I met with her a couple times. Brooke and I pretty much picked every song except the very last song at the end of the film that Ruby sings. And by the way, I don't know how many of you picked up on it, but she's humming that song at the beginning of the film. Oh, you guys got that? All right. Anyway, yeah.
Trust the audience.
Yeah, exactly. Trust the audience. So, yeah, so I worked with her. She's incredibly accomplished, and I had some ideas of stuff, but, you know, she's like, okay, here, this song would be good here. And, you know, with an independent film, you have to watch your money, and you can't get every song that you want. There was a Willie Nelson song I wanted. You know, it just cost too much money. We couldn't use it, so... But yeah, and Pat was adamant about that from day one. He said, look, what's going to make this film, considering we don't have a character that talks, is the music. We got to have phenomenal music. And I felt like we did.
Yeah.
While we're waiting for another brave soul to step up to the mic, there's another question, written question from the audience. What was your budget, and did you go over your budget?
Our budget was $400,000, and we went over by $30,000.
Yeah.
And what did your executive producer have to say about that?
It was fine. It made perfect sense. You know, we'd spent very well and very intelligently on the right things, and and sort of focused on stuff that was going to make a difference in the film, and so it was just fine.
So I mean, we have 9 minutes left.
I had a sort of a follow up on that. There's a good story about the resolution. So, as Suman said earlier, Jenna and Robert came up to work the film and hadn't signed on yet, hadn't signed a contract, just wanted to kind of get to know us. They were sort of committed to the project, like the script, and they were hopeful.
They're like, let's see how this really goes.
So they looked at the camera. They kind of checked it out. And I actually built the camera larger than it needed to be just to make it imposing and impressive. I had seen this video with
it's
Nicolas
Cage. It's a
different
kind of optics.
Well, there was a thing with Nicolas Cage, and he said, he made a mention about the cameras. He was afraid they were going to be too small, and as soon as he saw the matte box, he was familiar with it. So I just put a big matte box. So actors are used to seeing this big square with either a filter or a circle in it. So I built this big matte box, and I felt like it was cool, and she was way ahead of it. She's like, now let's turn the thing on. And so we shot a scene with her and Ruby, and I really spent a lot of time on the light and tried to pick at medium shots because I knew the wide shot was going to break apart in the corners and the close-up would just, kind of freak her out. And, actors don't really care for HD. That's something that, future filmmakers out there, don't think HD is going to get you any actors on board. They're really cool, like with SD. The skin's like no wrinkles, they love SD. So I shot it, and then we took the card out and put it in the laptop. And since it's upside down and flipped and flopped, we held the laptop in front of her upside down, and she watched it, and she was very quiet. And she actually just turned around and sat down. I thought, oh, it's a wrap. What a bummer. We're gonna have to get... And so she was very contemplative, and she said, gosh, I love it. It reminds me of Super 16mm film. It's not HD. I go, it's not HD. You're right. And she had a soft characteristic of it where it just didn't kind of, it allowed her wonderful friend and makeup artist who she brought with her to do her work. Because a lot of times these people get trumped. These makeup people are freaked out because they get trumped by these, hey, we're shooting in 5K. So you can literally jump out of that plane and we can have a close-up as you hit the ground. And they're like, I'm not interested. They really sort of like that comfortable zone of acting and hiding and characters. You can't hide behind HD. So she loved it. And that was like this sort of real kick in the pants that made us, wow, we got her on board. We're cooking.
Could you tell me a little bit about the actor who played the gardener? I mean, he was really good.
Yeah. So his name is Chris Marsh. He lives in Arizona. And when we wrote this script, we wanted to have real problems in the real world, and having somebody of some kind of ethnic background was really paramountly important for that role. And Chris is Egyptian, and it was a difficult thing because you're going to think this is a little silly. We had a list of actors, and on the top of that list for that character was Omar Sharif. And I actually thought I was going to get Omar, believe it or not, because...
Well, after you got Jenna Rollins.
Yeah. And Omar has a British agent, and he's old, and he didn't want to travel, and, as much as he is a true Hollywood legend, this film might have been too much, because when we shot this film, we didn't give ourselves... even one day for anybody being sick, the camera not working, bad weather. If everything didn't go perfectly, we would have been in a lot of trouble because we had the actors for a certain amount of time. And when that time was done, they're gone. And if you want them back, you have to pay a lot more money. We were already 30 grand over budget.
And you get beat up on page 28.
So with Omar...
By the time we didn't get any of the kind of the big names... I can't remember his name, but the Indian guy from the TV show Lost, we were looking at him. And ultimately, my casting director, Robin Lippin, who's just brilliant, she said, look, there's this Egyptian actor. Please look at his audition. It is so good. And I'm not kidding you. When I saw Chris Marr's audition, I cried. There was a tear. It just went like this. And I went, that's the guy. And one thing you want in an actor is as soon as you cast them, you better hope and pray that they call you immediately and have a million questions for you about the script and the character. And that's what Chris did. He cared so much about this role and this character. And
stayed an extra week.
He stayed an extra week, yeah. He was just around to help us out if we need to do pickup shots, whatever. Brilliant, brilliant man.
So, Chris, could I notice you turning a little queasy when they mentioned Omar Sharif and bringing him over from Egypt?
No, not at all. Not at all. Again,
I just thought I saw that. I may be mistaken. All right. Do we have any other questions from the audience? Anything?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Go back to the...
Could you please step up to the mic?
It's the same person, everyone.
But a very intelligent person.
Yes.
I was curious about the thinking that went into the costuming for the little girl.
Right. Okay. So we had two costume designers. So when we shot the camera test to hopefully get Nokia on board originally before Chris Kelly came on board, we had one costume designer. And when Pat and I were talking about the role of Olive, we wanted someone who would be timeless. Someone who had been doing this for hundreds, thousands of years, an outfit that could transcend time.
Her last trip to the mall was like 1910. She had the little high leather shoes.
Or 1610.
The very dress. But she was a mix, right? She had a radio, which is something she found, sort of this contemporary thing to allow her to communicate. And at the end of the movie, it's sort of revealed that this is a new trick. It's, you know, there's a loophole in the law. She can start to, like, really play with her character. So, yeah, it was a sort of a calico, a lot of everything.
Yeah, we were just looking for an outfit that was timeless. And look, when you cast someone, what you originally have in mind for them to wear completely changes based on their hair and their skin tone and their eyes. If she was blonde or redhead, I'm sure the outfit would probably be a lot different. And that's one thing, you know, about filmmaking is don't be married to anything, really. I mean, what you think is the greatest idea is the next day you're like, what was I thinking? That's ridiculous. Thank God we went that direction, you know.
I want to remind everybody that we're speaking with Hooman Khalili, Pat Gillis, and Chris Kelly from the film Olive. And I'd also like to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and internet for joining us at the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Mark Fishkin, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you all.